Watch this. No way!
Hello and welcome back to the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast. I'm your host for today, Sam Williams, and I'm joined by Tom Mills.
Hello.
And we are joined by a special guest, Harry Cloke.
Oh yeah, how's it going?
How you doing, Harry? So we've spoken to Harry a couple of times now and kind of really cool to bring him on the pod. It's not very often you hear of a tech startup, big data company out in Shoreditch working to improve and build on course architecture and develop the game of golf. And really excited to bring Harry on today to talk about that. I think it's a really interesting project, and I think he has some really cool innovative ideas in terms of where the game will go in the future. So rather than looking back into the history books, we're going to be looking forward. And without further ado, we welcome Harry onto the pod. So Harry, how are you surviving things during lockdown?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you. Just getting on with some work, but it's been all right, really. What about yourself?
Yeah, we've been good. And luckily enough, in the podcasting business, we're able to kind of do things remotely like today. Harry, kind of just skipping through kind of our chats and a bit about your history. You studied golf at university. You're a really kind of keen architecture buff, and you're looking to use, kind of modern technology to shape how we work in the golf industry. Just kick us off by telling us a bit about golf architecture and how that became like such an interest for you.
I think for me, I started playing golf when I was probably 13 or 14. And I mean, it's easy to look back and say this, but I think I was pretty interested in it straight away. The main thing for me was just golf, I guess, presents like a series of problems for you to try and solve. And I just loved hitting different shots, trying to work out how best to kind of negotiate a golf course. I think at first I did that by being extremely wild off the tee. So I just sort of leave myself in kind of all sorts of positions, but that's what I loved. I think like there was a few probably watershed moments for me playing golf. Probably the biggest one was I played down at Littlestone, was the first links course I ever played. And I went down there and I just absolutely loved it. Just you could hit every shot, so many shots I'd never even thought of before, I was having to play. And, you could stick it close from 350 yards and you could take six to get down from 20. Like, it just absolutely anything could happen. And I just loved the way that those questions are asked of you. And kind of I was lucky enough to play a lot of the good courses down in the southeast of England and from Kent originally. I think playing those, you start to realize that kind of formulas for how great golf courses, ask the most questions, I guess. I mean, another moment for me would be the fourth hole at Woking, standing on the tee. There's a little central pot bunker and just trying to work out how am I supposed to play this hole? What do I do? Do I hit drive? Do I hit 7-iron? Do I go left? Do I go right? That's where it kind of started for me.
And I think the courses that give you a mental workout are always the most rewarding, and there's nothing worse than dull golf courses where there's very little trouble to navigate or where the design doesn't ask you any kind of key questions. You're now the director of Shore Hill Golf Analytics, so we're going to talk quite a bit about Shore Hill and that project and your company and what you're trying to achieve. But you've essentially set out to use big data in a way that influences how not only you can improve the player experience, but you can help golf courses and golf course architects to improve, modify, improve maintenance and, general running order of the course. Where did the idea come from originally around using big data? Because that's typically quite a course architecture I look at as being quite an artistic subject, or certainly when you look back at the kind of golden era architects. And what you're doing is taking kind of like a scientific approach.
Yeah. I mean, for me, where the idea came from was since kind of when I was a junior, I'm a big golf nerd, really. And I used to, if I was playing a new golf course, I'd always research it the night before. And a lot of the time, the golf club would have some statement saying, this golf course is challenging for the best player, yet enjoyable for the complete beginner. And then you turn up and I'd see sort of no evidence to suggest that. And I it just posed the question to me, what does that hole or golf course look like that's able to actually engage with people of different standards? And I kind of thought logically on that line, if we understood exactly how everyone's playing a golf course, maybe we can sort of move toward that aim. And then kind of fast forward a few years and things like Arcos and Game Golf are coming out and they're showing that tracking mass data, understanding where golfers are hitting shots on golf courses is possible with the technology that's available. To be honest, I was just waiting for someone to use it for the purposes of golf course architecture, and then nobody did. So I thought, well, why don't I just do it myself? I think with regard to the sort of art versus science thing, I guess it's somewhere in the middle. I quite enjoy golf as like an art form. I'm not all about data, I suppose, but I think data is kind of the core of understanding how the golfer engages with the golf course. So we're not kind of using data to apply just a singular model to every golf course. I think the beauty of golf is the fact that every golf course is different and each golf course kind of presents different things to different people. But it's just trying to understand that relationship between the golf and the golf course better so that we can make decisions better and more precisely moving forward.
So what is it you're looking at from an architectural point of view? Are you analyzing big data and thinking, okay, well, if this trap was here, it might penalize the better player. If we remove this trap, it might let play a bit easier for the people who can't hit it as far. Maybe this part area by the greens are runoff. What is it exactly you're sort of looking at to adjust or improve a golf course?
So I think, first off, I'd say that each golf course is different. And again, we're not just applying like a singular model to everyone. We want to look at data within the context of what's intended of a golf course. I think a lot of the golf courses around the world, the lower quality golf courses, they're not kind of devoid of strategy, but often what's intended isn't actually playing out for the everyday golfer. I think if you look at the best golf courses from a data perspective, they're most able to engage with golfers and different golfers. Whereas kind of the worst, the lower quality golf courses are less able to do that. So it's just trying to sort of analyze an entire golf course and say, what's the purpose? What's the intended purpose of each feature of a golf course? And say, kind of, can we do more to heighten that, to improve the quality of the golf course, the strategy of the golf course? So it's like a whole, there's a lot of different ways that you can do that. I think a sort of overriding principle of golf course architecture is sort of shot values and angles. So great golf courses, you might have a wide fairway, width is a big thing, but you maybe want to hit towards one side. It's a matter of positional play. So looking at the statistics for what's actually identifying the lowest score or what's kind of the prerequisite for the best scores. So like on less good golf courses, you'd probably say driving distance is the main identifier of a low score. So the further you hit it, the more likely you are to make birdie. Better golf courses, you're going to see more interesting data patterns where you're getting into certain positions where you can get a better angle in. So it's kind of picking apart golf courses from that statistical standpoint and then working out how our golfers actually experiencing what they're supposed to experience strategically.
So Harry, how does that work in practice then? So, you know, I'm in charge of golf club A and I want to understand the length and breadth of all of the golfers that come and play at my golf club. How do I actually go about understanding that? Because not all golfers hit the ball the same. People play from different starting points. The course will play different in different conditions, be it wind, ground conditions, green speed. How do you actually take all those variables? How does the whole thing come together?
So, I mean, we're trying to track as much data as we can, and we track it all in relation to every one of those variables that you've mentioned. So we basically give out wearable devices to golfers, and then it automatically tracks all their shots they've hit on the golf course. We then have a cloud-based system where you can pull out basically any statistics you want to see, and we provide a consultation service. So we can pull up hundreds of thousands of statistics for any single area of golf course. I think the important thing is how you interpret that. And the easiest way to do that is probably looking at a golf course and saying, what is the golf course trying to achieve, or what are we trying to present to our golfers? So you might have, say, a hole that's supposed to be a risk-reward par four. We can actually analyze, is anyone laying up? Is everyone going for the green? If they miss the green, what is essentially the risk values of that shot? Because they might have a pretty easy up and down from missing the green. You know, I think, again, better golf courses will have much more interesting data patterns. Worse golf courses will just have, will only play in one single way. I mean, you look at the great golf courses and you'll see really interesting data patterns. I think, you know, we were talking before about the old course at St. Andrews. I think what makes that great is the huge variety and the kind of shift in strategy day to day for that golf course. So if you say, take the second hole, you know, there's these huge undulations kind of on the front left of that green. If you have the pin back right, and the course is playing soft and the wind's maybe 5-10 miles an hour into your face, you can pretty much spray that drive. It's a very low risk drive. You're just aiming, you can hit it in the left rough versus the left side of the fairway versus the right side, and say the strokes gained approach statistics or the average proximity statistics for that hole would be very similar. There wouldn't be much difference between being right or left. If you move that pin then behind the ridges, you kind of, the golf course is playing a lot firmer, maybe it's a little downwind. All of a sudden there's huge pressure on that tee shot, because there might be like a shot or a shot and a half difference between those hitting from the left rough to the very right edge of the fairway. So I think like that's an example of where the data patterns show the kind of variety of challenge faced at somewhere like the old course versus, I don't know, some of these championship golf courses built in like the 70s, 80s, 90s. Again, driving distance will be the main cause of lower scoring. Doesn't matter if you're in the right edge of the fairway or the left side, or sometimes even in the rough, if the rough's cut down, you're pretty much going to have the same statistics for approach shots either way. So there's little strategy.
There's a lot on there where you've got those, you know, it's binary. You either hit the fairway or you are coming out sideways. You either carry the hazard or you're taking relief and you're losing shots. And great courses do give you the option of finding different ways to play, and a lot more subtle. And I think the, you know, clearly the best example is the old course. How much do you drive in terms of like getting sample data? Because like I'm thinking now, you know, to understand even for just one golfer in the way they play with the same ball speed, driving distance, you name it, they all play radically different on a daily basis. So you must have to get like a ton of samples, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's, well, first off, that's kind of the key reason why we're in operation and doing what we're doing, because you think about how large a space a golf course is, and that golf course, you know, 100, 200, whatever acres, there's a huge amount of sort of finely maintained turf and hazards and water features, say. And then you're doing that all to challenge golfers of different abilities, who, as you say, just play the game so, so differently. It's incredibly complicated, which is why I think there's the need for data in the first place. But yeah, on that end, it depends what we're trying to see. Say we're brought into a golf course just to look at, you know, we want to just reevaluate the back tees for high-end tournaments, say. That's pretty simple. That'll only take a couple of hundred rounds, because better golfers is a very small group that we're trying to target, and better players have much more consistent patterns of play. If you kind of want to look at higher handicap players, and maybe, you know, men, women, 36 to, you know, 18 handicap, that's quite a big target group, and there's way more variety within how they play the game. So I think in reality, if you want to know everything about golf course, you can do a year, 2 years worth of data collection, looking at how the course changes over across seasons with changing pin positions, changing tee positions, with every different type of golfer playing it. But yeah, if you had a specific target market, you can do it in a week or two.
And in terms of, there's been a huge renaissance in sort of golf course architecture in the last decade or so, where people are really, I think, starting to try and recapture the golden age course designers and things. Are you having people and clubs coming to you and saying that, certainly some of the newer clubs coming to you and saying that they want to make their golf course harder, and there's sort of this misconception that making something harder makes it a better course, and then similarly, how do you sort of approach that in terms of, yeah, you want to make it difficult for the better players, but make it playable for the weaker players? So how do you get around that in terms of when you're advising golf courses on things like that?
Well, yeah, I think, again, that's quite a complicated thing to do. So again, hopefully with data, we can gain a better appreciation for the needs of different players. We've actually had a lot of interest from high level tournament golf courses who, you know, host a tournament 1 week of every year, but the rest of the time, their golf courses are probably a little bit brutal for the everyday golfer. And I think where we can come in is trying to sort of segregate where golfers of different standards are actually hitting shots and look at like a combined tee and rough management program where you can kind of keep the sort of playing lines of the better players nice and tight with a lot of the hazards dotted around where they're going to be playing, and then provide something a little bit easier and more negotiable for the everyday player. I think that's, yeah, kind of an interesting thing on playability and another misconception with what we do, that I've had a few people think that we're going to try and make golf courses, you know, perfectly fair and just sort of steamroll all the uniqueness and the quirks of golf courses using data. In actual fact, I think what we can best do for golf clubs is set about providing negotiable challenges for golfers of all standards. Like, it's quite a well-known psychological concept that we get enjoyment from overcoming obstacles. Like, the greater the obstacle, or the greater the obstacles perceived to be, the more enjoyment you're going to get. Obviously, no one really enjoys failing to overcome that obstacle. But if you set about negotiable hazards for golfers to try and overcome, they're not going to be able to overcome all of them. That's the nature of golf. But if you can make sure that they have the capability to kind of beat the golf course in that way, then I think that's the essence of playability. You don't have to allow them to perfectly play every hole. You just need to make sure that they can win enough times to keep coming back.
We've talked on the pod a little bit in the past and referenced, I think I mentioned when we spoke, Decade, so Scott Fawcett's work in terms of looking at how the amateur golfer can use some of the principles you get on the tour. So, you know, on top of all your TrackMan stats, you get like ball speed and all that kind of smash factor and angles and stuff. There's a lot of stuff on tour used around strokes gained and looking at distances and shot values. What does that then spit back out to the player? Because a lot of this is helping, arguably makes the course defend itself better or maybe maintain itself better or provide more playability. But what does it give it anything back to the player in terms of saying, you know what, you know, you, so where you can almost kind of reference the, when you look back, you can say, well, you know, strategically, have I played the hole wrong there? Have I made the wrong, you know, decisions out on the course? Does it do anything in terms of that?
Well, absolutely. We provide that as part of our service. So anyone who uses our system will be able to view their own statistics. And we also provide stats to players' coaches should they wish, so we can send through all their information. And we've built our own database and kind of analytics platform. So we're able to pull comparable statistics. So say you're an 8 handicap, you're able to segregate all of your game and work out where you're doing better or worse than people of the same handicap and kind of add into that how you're doing in relation to the golf course. So that is something we provide to players as part of it. You know, as we mentioned before, I think there's a lot of stat tracking things for the individual golfer. So our primary concern is the golf course, but we're tracking all this data anyway, so we allow the golfers to view it, and we hope that adds value to their experience as well.
Does your data, obviously you can track quite easily timings of how people play golf courses and stuff, and are you able to or, you know, theoretically able to say, look, we can manage how play people enter the course and how they walk around the course, and we can actually get people around the course quicker by, you know, maybe with a specific time between tee times or anything like that? But is that a possibility?
Yeah, absolutely. So we can track where golfers are on the golf course in real time. So we know if there's any pace of play issues. And we also track that kind of retrospectively. So we know, I guess, where players are taking the longest time. So if there's a certain area where everyone's losing balls and they're all getting held up there, that's something you can view and make changes for. The one thing I'd probably say on that is that again, since we're trying to track a bunch of different people, we're not necessarily tracking every shot.
I suppose where I was going with it is, like, I think some courses, sort of as soon as it's physically possible, the next group is on the first tee and teeing off, and you can kind of get more people on the course, but it just takes a little bit longer to get around. Is this sort of possible to get some sort of tangible look? If you all wait a specific set time, will all get around quicker if you won't be waiting.
I mean, we track all the data necessary to make that call. It remains to be seen whether there's a kind of insight in that vein, I guess. And once again, each golf course is different, really. So yeah, we track all the data necessary to make that call. But yeah, I don't know. I guess it'd be interesting to see how, yeah, that pans out. I know there's other tech that exclusively tracks people's pace of play. I don't know what their findings would be necessarily on that. But yeah, we track where golfers are moving and where they're walking. And once they have the watch on, we spoke to an architect recently who does a lot of designing of like short game areas and stuff. And he always says his job's to kind of manage not just the golf course, but everything from when they set foot on property to when they leave. So if you give them the watch soon enough, or if they're wearing their own watch and they're logged into the system soon enough, you can see everything even before the tee time, if they're using range facilities, if they're going to the chipping green, putting green, generally how long they take. Again, it's all pretty easy to track. It just depends what a golf course, what issues
that would
have.
Be a quality stat to release. I would love to know how long the amateur spends between getting out of the car and actually tipping on the first tee. I bet it's nowhere near.
I can tell you it's probably not enough. I can guarantee.
No, not at all. Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
A big part of your model is to help golf courses with environmental impact. What is it that you can do and offer in terms of the environmental benefit then? Because I'm quite naive in the way that I approach this. Is it the way that you perhaps set out how they do the irrigation, or I mean, I really don't have a clue. So how do you go about helping with the environmental impact?
Yeah, so I think, I'd say that our system works. You can kind of sum it up in three levels. One would be the environmental. The second would be kind of reducing the maintenance of a golf course, which helps environmentally anyway. And the third would be the golf course architecture. So both maintenance and the sort of environmental aspects is all about reviewing area usage versus the kind of input that you have. So how can we reduce the total area of maintained turf, say, or the total area of irrigated turf without negatively impacting the golfer experience, or hopefully even helping them? One thing that we're working on now is trying to tie in our data with, we've got some like underground sensors, so looking at like soil moisture, soil temperatures, stuff like that. So trying to work out if you are to reduce irrigation, what's the impact on the soil health, but also what's the impact on the golfer experience, which I guess at the end of the day, they're two are the most important things. So we're hoping that kind of watering's a big one for golf courses, using more water than they need to. We're going to tell them where you can cut it out completely, where you can maybe reduce it. And then even in those high use areas, we can try and just fine tune it so that you're using as little water as possible, and kind of as little impact and input as possible while still maintaining the golfer experience, which is obviously the core product.
And we've talked on the pod a few times, and we've had people on, and the subject comes up, like, golf has almost become in part a bit of a gardening experience, and by that I mean an exercise in very high expectations around, you know, 13 on the stimp is better than 12, the greens need to be as fast as lightning, fairways need to be like carpet everywhere, and the expectations, I think, over time of golf courses to present themselves in that kind of, in the sort of, you know, quote unquote garden feel, has become almost impossible. And that's driving up huge costs for the golfer, costs for the club. And actually, I think you can kind of come away from that. Does this technology kind of, that should help with this? Like, what's your take on it? As we've got this distance debate, we've got bigger courses, bigger holes, we're needing to move tees back. The cost of maintaining courses is constantly going up, which means the cost to the end golfer. Like, something's got to give in my head, and without kind of, you know, kind of off the corporate record, if you want. But, you know, what's your take on all that? Because it feels like somewhere, somehow, we're going to have to make some difficult decisions. We want to have really hot, wide fairways to give maximum strategic choice to the golfer. We want to play from loads of different angles, but we also want all of our greens to be running at 13, and we want our fairway to be like velvet. Well, unless you're prepared to pay £10,000-£15,000 a man to be a member of these places, it's just not feasible. So somewhere, somehow, we have to make some sacrifices. And whether that's by neglecting a certain part or allowing a certain part to kind of die off and become kind of less pristine, for want of a better term, I'm just kind of interested in your take and how, you know, someone who's visits lots of courses and kind of works with lots of clubs, how do you see that at the moment?
You're giving me a lot to chat about.
I know
about
it's
there.
A bit of a ramble. I do it regularly.
No, it's I think, like, yeah, width. I'll start with width. Width was a good one you mentioned there. That's kind of the golf course architecture movement at the moment, is pushing for more and more width on golf courses. But we've got this kind of environmentalism that's kind of pushing back. So I think stuff like that's going to be a problem moving forward. And again, I hope with our system, it's all about efficiency and working out what's a priority, what's lower priority, and where you can maybe make some savings where it doesn't actually impact the golfer, or even better, how you can arrange things so that the golfers can have a better experience whilst you've actually kind of reduced your maintenance input, which I think is very important. I think with regard to the distance debate, so the thing is with me, I've realized that I have a slightly different view on golf and golf course architecture than a lot of people. Personally, I think it's all about the golfer. It's all about the golfer-golf course relationship and how golf can kind of function. I don't think there's necessarily any shoulds. A golf course should look one way or another. So, like, with us hitting the ball further, it doesn't bother me on the grounds that I think you can still produce quality golf course architecture with people hitting the ball longer. But I think there's two very, very big problems. One's the fact that if you want to do that, you need more space and you need more maintained turf, and that costs more money, and that's, you know, detrimental to the environment. So that is problematic. I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with hitting the ball a long way until you dig into what the actual implications of that. And then you get some huge problems, and you also get got great historic golf courses that are being devalued by that fact. So I don't quite know what the solution is. But yeah, I certainly think it's problematic. And then golf takes 5 hours because the golf course is 8,000 yards and it's a huge long walk. So yeah, I think that's highly problematic. And again, if we can get back to a point of evaluating necessity, I mean, I think one other thing our system can do is just look at who's actually playing a golf course. Because I think a lot of golf clubs are keen to make it pro proof and, you know, make it 7,000 plus yards. You know, we can tell them this percentage of golfers are actually able to hit the ball 300 yards. And again, each golf course is going to be different, but I guarantee that percentage isn't very high. So maybe we might be able to help them stop worrying so much about protecting against the big boys, I guess.
And when you look at the big data in terms of when you analyze a specific course, are you able to tangibly say to a course, look, this bunker gets hit 0.5% of the time, you know, don't go invest in a huge amount of money in this, like nobody's in it ever. Are you able to give those types of data of feedback and allow courses to kind of change that way?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, with that example, we'll be able to tell you, what percentage of total players are going in the bunker, what their handicaps are, what their age is, in what conditions, what tees they played off. If they've gone in there, what's their average distance that they've hit away from? I can pretty much tell you anything about it. I could ramble on for the rest of the podcast probably with stats we could give you. So I think the first thing I'd say is, if 0.5% are going in that bunker, let's just, before we change anything, let's just look at what is the intended purpose of that bunker. I had a conversation quite recently with an architect who was one of the kind of naturalist, sort of minimalist architects. And he, you know, he said, oh, but I really like to build four bunkers. So bunkers that are like 50, 60 yards off the tee. You know, using your stats, you know, 0.1% of players would go in there. So you'd suggest you take it out. That's not actually the case. I think in that instance, if they're there for artistic reasons, we're not going to be looking at how many players are going in the bunker, because it's not relevant if it's there for artistic reasons. If in the case of a lot of four bunkers, so you look at like Alistair McKenzie, he did a lot of four bunkering to try and deceive the golfer. In that instance, we're not looking at the number of players who go in it, but the bunker is actually going to have an impact on players, say, hitting the green because of that deceptive element. I mean, a good example would be the golf course outside Paris, Saint-Germain, which is a Harry Colt golf course. It's a par three, I think it's the fifth hole, and they've got these really deceptive bunkers right in front of the tee. And it's really hard to gauge the distance. And I'll tell you, I'm certain that if you started collecting data on that, you would see a disproportionate number of people missing the green. So if the deceptive bunkers make the green look closer than it is, you'd see a disproportionate number of people hitting short of the green than on the green compared with shots of a similar distance. So with features like that, if you're looking at the number of golfers who are going in the bunker, you're looking at the wrong stats. And again, I think that's something I'm keen to try and explain about big data, is it can tell you so much more than just where golfers are and aren't hitting shots, I guess.
And how difficult is it to pull that apart? So using that example and saying, you know, you've got some bunkers that are 60 yards off the tee, they're not in play. And then, but then your argument may be, but this causes an issue down the line because you may not hit the fairway because you're deceived by these bunkers. Obviously, you can't play that hole without the bunkers. So how difficult is it to pull that apart in the statistics? Is that easy? Because it sounds quite difficult.
Again, each one's different. Yeah, it kind of, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an example of how of what you mean. So I guess, like, if you're looking at those four bunkers, you know, what's the impact? Yeah, I guess you could say the compound impact of how golfers are playing the hole. Like, it all requires comparable data sets that you can look at and say this compared to, so again, that par three, I think it's like 170, 180 yards. For a shot of that distance with a green that sized, or even forgetting the green, with a shot of that distance, how different is the sort of dispersion? And yeah, like say a par five, it gets more and more difficult further down the hole what the actual impact is, the sort of compound impact is. But, you know, we can look at, we've sort of created our own version of like strokes gain statistics. So you can look at going in the bunker, the severity of the penalty of going in the bunker, and then see for their next shot where they went and what the eventual score was. So like if you're looking at bunkers, if someone's in it versus next door to it, what is the comparative difference in scoring average, in the average distance of their next shot, stuff like that. So again, it takes a bit of experimenting with, and this is why we provide consultation too, because the data is so vast and so complicated, and why it also helps to try and look at the golf course first and say, what are we trying to achieve? Because looking at it through that light, you can start to, I guess, give some context to the data.
I'm quite interested, Harry, in what the architects kind of feel about this, because I think you spoke at the European Institute of Golf Course Architects fairly recently, and if I'm an architect and I'm sat there and I think, actually, let's say it's an art form, let's call it something different, it doesn't really matter. It's based on largely my judgment of how I see the topography and how I interpret the course and its surroundings to provide something great. And then you're there saying, well, I can decode this with numbers. I can imagine, I don't know, maybe the cynic in me tells me you probably, and I think you've kind of mentioned it there where you're talking about the four bunkering. It's like, I get you can do so much with numbers, but really, you know, what's the feedback from kind of some of the, because you'd have had some of the industry's best there. What was the feedback when you're kind of going through this stuff?
I think, so I've also been out to the States a couple of times. And I think European architects are a little bit quicker to embrace it than American architects on the grounds that I feel like a lot of American architects are a little bit more, I'm trying to think of the right word.
You can be as gay as you want here, Harry. You can honestly.
I think they may be more idealistic, or like a lot of, if you speak to American architects, they'll maybe speak a lot more about, you know, what happened in the Golden Age and reproducing sort of Golden Age elements and utilizing nature. I think a lot of the European, like just the market in Europe, is a bit more functionality based. So I think that maybe is why they potentially get it a little quicker. The one thing I'd say is it's had a ton of support, but I also don't think until we can show people the data after a year or 2 years of data collection, I don't think anyone's quite grasped the sort of the total uses that it can have. And, you know, with regard to, because I think that's a common argument against it at first, is people say, oh, golf course, yeah, it's an art form, or it's all about intuition and things like that. It's a bit bolder for me, but I sort of disagree, really. I think like a lot of people would look at great golf courses and say, oh, great golf courses should utilize the landscape and utilize nature and the land. And I guess my thing is, utilize for what ends? Even the best sites in the world have a bunch of options that you can choose between. And all we're trying to do is use data and statistics to tell you what is the best option, what's going to have the best end result for the golfer. So we don't want to come in and just, I think that's one of the mistakes of golf courses in the 70s and 80s. They were just applying, no matter what the natural landscape was like, they're just applying a model to that and designing from paper and, you know, not designing in the field. Really, I think the way people should look at what we do is this is our version of being in the field. Like, we're trying to understand the golfer-golf course relationship, and we have to do it through a computer and through data analysis, but it's better understanding what's out there and in front of you and how to make use of it. So I think it ties in. And I think a lot of Golden Age concepts, you know, we can use data to actually ensure that they are best utilized. I mean, in fact, you can go back to the Golden Age and find some, I don't want to say justification, because I never knew the Golden Age architects, so I can't speak for them. But, you know, you look at Donald Ross at Pinehurst, you know, lived there a good chunk of his life and constantly editing the golf course based on the way he saw people playing the golf course, understanding it. I heard reports recently of like Oakmont, and I think it was debatable, but apparently at Merion, putting in bunkers after they'd opened the golf course, so seeing where divots were and putting in bunkers. It's something that happened, and it's a different way of doing it, but we're just trying to increase our understanding of how golfers engage with a golf course and then make decisions off of that. So I don't think it's actually counters this idea of naturalism or that kind of art form style. I hope that it's able to actually complement it and provide a different angle.
Just a broader point, I suppose, around courses, health of the game, where we see things moving and changing in time. You're kind of in the business, you are quote unquote an expert on these things. What do you see as the big trends? What do you see are the big, you know, kind of shifts we're going to see? Those kind of days of championship par 72 with corridors of trees and vast kind of maintenance budgets feel like they're in their final days. So where does the world of course design, course architecture go? What are the kind of big things that you can see on the horizon?
I mean, it's definitely moving that way, isn't it? But it's hard to tell how big a move that is. I think like the architectural community's grown. There's definitely more people interested in golf course architecture than there was 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. I think, you know, stuff like Golf Club Atlas has done a huge job there, and then now social media platforms are having a huge effect. I think just as a general rule for the world over, data is going to become more and more important. Who knows whether it's us or someone else, but you know, I think it will become more and more commonplace and used more. I don't know, it's interesting. The main concern I have about the current climate of golf course architecture, and one of the things that I hope data can help change, you saw back in the 70s, 80s, these golf courses, I've heard people call them cookie cutter designs. They were just, there was a theory on a golf course should look like this. It should have, should be perfectly green. It should have these big bunkers. It should have lakes, should have big soft greens. And then this naturalist movement was like the counterculture, and kind of now it's become the culture. But I still see a lot of people in the industry kind of working on the same lines, saying a golf course should be brown. It should be firm and fast. It should be, you know, using the natural landscape. But the problem I have with that is that's kind of an opinion.
It's the new cookie cutter, isn't it? You've just changed the cookie cutter then, really, for you.
Exactly, yeah. And I think where I hope we can help is, again, by shifting the focus onto the golf course relationship. Because I think the only thing you can say about golf is, yes, it's a game we've created to entertain ourselves. So surely the human aspect of it is the only thing that's of importance. And there's no prerequisite for a golf course to be natural or to be anything else by that matter, as long as it's entertaining or enjoyable to the golfer. And I mean that as kind of a wide word. It doesn't have to be, could be fun, it could be difficult, it could be draining, it could be crazy. But I think if we look at that and golf courses as that, then like this naturalist movement actually still kind of comes out on top, because I think natural landscapes have often, good natural landscapes have way more variety than the kind of human hand could actually deal with. And it has, and it provides, I guess, something enjoyable for the golfer in that you're outside in nature. And firm and fast conditions, like we've kind of touched on, they provide more options and more variety, and variety is good in keeping us entertained for longer. But I think it provides a way that we can look at golf courses that kind of opens up our spectrum of what can be built. I think if some people say to me, golf courses are all about being natural and using the natural landscape, I say to them, you know, why is Pete Dye considered in such high regard? What happens to golf courses that are in a bad site? And I think if we change our focus to what can we do for the golfer, then it opens up a whole world of different things we can do, and it provides those golf courses with worse sites more opportunity to actually get better and kind of improve what they can improve, because obviously they can't really improve their site itself.
And there's lots of examples, aren't there? I mean, even going back well over 100 years, looking at like Seminole, for example, that course is a bad site for a golf course, I think. But Donald Ross found a way of making that piece of land work brilliantly well by changing the way that drainage works and being able to alter the terrain through the topography and playing along the ridges. And it's just a, like you say, it becomes, if the new cookie cutter becomes just about finding, you know, all courses look like this, and then you just create a new norm, and that's no good for anyone. What do you see in terms of, like, I suppose, you know, excluding things like the old course we've already talked about, do you kind of have any courses that, you know, really inspire you, really excite you? Do you have a particular designer that you're sort of like, you know, like, wow, that their work is, I think, the most kind of significant or the most interesting?
I mean, to take the designer on, I mean, there's two people that spring to mind. One is pretty hard to ignore, Harry Colt, when you've grown up in the UK. His courses are everywhere. And I think, I'm not sure I personally think his golf courses are necessarily the greatest. Well, I'd put Alistair McKenzie slightly above him, I think. But I think he was a great router of golf courses. And like, if you make a golf course, I guess the routing's the one thing you can't change. And this is, again, where there's problems with these championship golf courses, because they're kind of relying, their value is in the fact it's perfectly maintained and it looks pretty, and it's long and challenging, but it's kind of all about that experience. But if you have a lot of Harry Colt golf courses are still fun, even though they've been completely run down in the UK. You can play a really run down Harry Colt golf course and you still have fun. And that's because it makes use of the land, and the shots you have to play are fun because of the way that they negotiate the land. So I think he's pretty good for that. I mean, Alistair McKenzie, it's a bit of a cliche to say Alistair McKenzie, I think everyone does. But the thing I love about him was yeah, I guess the human touch to what he did. He tried to bring in aspects of art and kind of like deceptive elements. Like a lot of his bunkering is absolutely stunning. I think, you know, he worked on some great sites and he made use of those sites very well. But like that extra touch of Alistair McKenzie is what turned, you know, a good golf course on a great site into, you know, the world's best golf courses. And I think that's really important. You look at like Cypress Point, say, his work there. I mean, one thing I absolutely love about him at Cypress Point and I admire so much is apparently he was a little bit annoyed that nobody or fewer people were outraged by his design at Cypress Point because he wanted to do something that was pretty out there and pretty different and would kind of push the envelope a little bit. So, I mean, I love that. And you look at his design there, you've got stunning holes by the coast, but a lot of the inland holes are sort of inspiring in themselves. And what he did visually in terms of deception, just bringing in these, like, I guess the human aspect I really admire. Yeah, I think that's what he turned great sites into amazing golf courses with that extra little touch, I suppose.
Harry, it's been an absolute blast having you on. What can we look forward to seeing from you in the next few months as we start to come out of lockdown? Have you got some good projects you're going to be working on?
Yeah, I think so. I can't really release any names at the moment, but pending the sort of situation with the pandemic, we're hoping to get started at a few clubs in the UK, Ireland, hopefully France, Mexico, Canada, US. It's quite a good mix of people we've got from kind of private places to resorts to kind of semi-private, smaller golf clubs. So I'm hoping, as I said before, I think what we're doing, a lot of people don't grasp quite what you can know from data and the how useful it can be. So kind of looking forward, I think we've got a good set of different golf clubs where we can prove almost every different scenario where we're of use. So keep your eyes peeled, I guess.
And that's the exciting part, right? You know, the fact that this data exists and, you know, probably not even you know what we can do with that stuff yet, but we know that it's going to help provide better insight and help kind of better manage some of the problems that exist in the game and help improve it for players. So, Harry, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been an absolute blast. And we wish you all the very best for the future.
Thank you very much. Cheers, guys. I really enjoyed it.
Watch Cheers, Harry. This.